At the East Bay branch of the Vedanta Society, located in Berkeley, just off the university campus and sitting in the midst of Southside rooming houses, Swami tried to get everyone involved in the work of that center. Teachers, students, professional people, all were asked to come for just a few hours a week and weed or pick up leaves. Mrs. Mathersmith was robust, vigorous, and not a little formidable and dictatorial. She directed the garden with professional skill and dedication to her guru. But Swami kept many plans and practical moves in his own mind and hand. In that memorable year, there was a funeral for all of us to attend. Miss Sarah Fox, retired schoolteacher, president of the society, and very close to Swami, had her farewell in one of the funeral chapels of the city. The atmosphere of this affair raised it above any funeral of my experience, before or since. Everyone present remarked on it. Even the staff of the chapel were struck from their proverbial pallor and unction by the vibrancy, the air of hovering joy surmounting the whole occasion, and asked members afterwards about their society and their faith. The darkness of death seemed totally defied by the unseen current of conviction and sublimity pervading the service. But it was not all joy for Swami. Even while chanting from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he broke down, his voice in tatters. One of the few occasions when I saw him overcome in public by his private feelings. At a Sunday lecture months later, he remarked that Miss Fox, whom he had addressed as sister, had been the most spiritual person he had met in this country. One of the properties owned by the Northern California Society was Shanti Ashrama, settled as a retreat in the beginning of the century by a struggling but intrepid band of hardy pioneers led by Swami Turiyananda, another of Sri Ramakrishna's disciples. Remote and in some ways inhospitable, Shanti Ashrama suffered subsequent disuse, principally because of the lack of any extensive usable water supply. It serves well to illustrate the impropriety of criticism and carping on the part of Vedanta students regarding a place other than their own. I have heard Swami Ashokananda chided in absentia for failing to develop this place in the San Antone Valley, where Swami Turiyananda had lived and worked at the command of Swamiji. Ignoring those wonderful vibrations, he sought other property closer by, which he would have to purchase. Long, careful weighing of many factors had gone into Swami's decision. Accessibility, the nature of prospective retreatants, development and transportation costs, the property's basic resources, and his own strength. The ensuing choice, purchase, and development of the retreat in Marin County appears to have borne out the wisdom of Swami's judgment in many ways. The fact that a piece of land was available close to Camp Taylor, where Swami Vivekananda had camped in 1900, played a large part in the decision. Swami was strong on maintenance. He would allow nothing belonging to Sri Ramakrishna to become tacky, and regular schedules of structural testing, rebracing, repainting, refurnishing were carried out for all the premises. Of course, the old temple was the most demanding, one marveled, even years later, that the Berkeley Temple looked as if it had recently been constructed. For us, the ordinary members not in the ruling circle, the closest view we had of how things were done was at the annual business meeting. Whatever money-raising was done at these meetings was accomplished through the voice of someone other than the Swami. In fact, with all their vast undertakings and enterprises, I never heard either Swami Ashokananda or Swami Prabhavananda make any public financial appeals. But meetings for business were not the only annual assemblies. There was also an annual reception in June, at which, in addition to music, there were appropriate remarks from the Swamis and the reading of a paper. Assigned well in advance to some distinguished member, this disquisition on a controversial topic seldom failed to arouse intellectual expectation and excitement. Who can pioneer a new religion? That was the topic one year in the 60s when gurus and cults were appearing on every side. These receptions were lively affairs as questions from the floor followed the paper. Swami once held a symposium with a group of some half dozen of his own most stimulating students on the lecture by Swami Vivekananda called "Is Vedanta the Future Religion?" This lecture, which had recently been recovered and reconstructed from the notes of Ida Ansel, had made a stir among those to whom it had been shown. The symposium was conducted in a series of meetings over many months, and when an edited transcript of the conversations, all properly pseudonymous, even Swami was Mr. Randolph, came out in the three issues of The Voice of India, people were overwhelmed. The discussion had been frank, free, intellectually intricate, and sophisticated. Devotees in other places and centers who have seen these rare copies of the magazine and encountered this symposium have marveled that there was ever a group discussion at such a level in the Vedanta Society. At the time, it seemed to be nothing out of the ordinary. The New Discoveries books of Swami Ashokananda's student Marie-Louise Burke, for which the entire career of Swami Vivekananda in the West was researched in detail, are the result of a literary collaboration of the most painstaking kind. I had the privilege to observe, only occasionally and from a distance, this relationship. The help which Swami must have given Mrs. Burke in initiating trains of thought and lines of pursuit, the loan of various arcane materials he had saved through the years, and the degree to which her discoveries may or may not have substantiated conjectures which he had entertained, all would make a wonderful story, if someday it could all be told. I was awed and inspired by the little of it that I saw. One day in Berkeley, when a number of us were milling around, something provoked Swami into blurting out vehemently, "I do not care anything about any of you. All I care about is the work." I was shocked, but I doubt that anyone listening believed it. Talking about it later, we agreed on the hollow ring it had had. Living around him was an experience of having our sentimentality continually eroded. We became accustomed to it, And as I said, what was his work if not man-making? He had his own ways of keeping his mind above all this constant activity. Sometimes I rode with him as his driver took him across the bay to give the Berkeley services, in the days before he had an assistant. Sitting just behind him in the car, I could observe that his right arm hung down beside the seat, and on the joints of his fingers he was ticking off, in the Indian manner, repetitions of the name of the Lord all the way over the bridge and up to the temple. If I could summarize Swami Ashokananda and his work in a single word, it would have to be capacity. He was a giant. At the time of my arrival, he was giving a lecture every Wednesday evening in San Francisco, a scripture class Thursday evening in Berkeley, and a class in San Francisco on Friday evening. Sunday there was the morning lecture in San Francisco, and one that evening in Berkeley. In between were interviews, a dozen work projects and plans, the monastery, starting a convent, the magazine, a Sunday school, public festivals, correspondence, and through all of this, the mercurial state of his health. On one occasion, someone was laying upon him effusive sentiments about how thrilled she was by Swami Vivekananda's rousing calls to service of the God in man. Had she, Swami wanted to know, ever tried to put her love of man into a plan of practical action? The lady admitted to being held back from that by various things. "Get in and work for people," he said sternly. "Then see how much you love them." Now, I have tried to test this instruction over many years, puzzling over what Swami really meant. Whether the heartbreaks and rejections inevitable in human service will cure one of a phony philanthropy complex, or whether one's love is thereby actually expanded to the infinity of the divine, like holy mothers. And I hope to reach a conclusion about this before this life is over. Another of his potent mantras on this subject was, "What you want others to do, do yourself." The new temple is progressing slowly, Swami wrote to me later when I was elsewhere. The trusses are up, very soon to be covered with sheathings, then roofing with slate tiles. So far, things seem satisfactory. The structure is more graceful than I expected. It will take 2 or 3 years more before the temple will be ready for dedication. He dreamed great dreams for the Olema retreat. He would go up on the ridge of those 2,000 seashore acres and describe its future, or to the so-called temple site, and envision aloud the temple to be built there one day. When I returned to Northern California in 1958, after difficult years, it was to the familiar premises of the old temple. Looking out from the eyrie of its roof, I felt disarmed, pinned, and held like a kitten by its mother's paw. And so thankfully. For those few moments, all strife seemed ended, all problems blown away in the marina breeze. I was home. New men, some very well educated, had joined. Swami had sent most of the older ones out to Olema and to Sacramento, the latest addition to the society. But here in San Francisco was old Mr. Brown and Al, now openly known by his Sanskrit name. So life in the old temple was much the same, except that there was this irrepressible energy of youth in the new recruits. Some found the way to weave their ebullience and love of fun right into the fabric of their spiritual and monastic adventure, and these were usually the ones who stayed. Organized interest in Vedanta had appeared in the city and suburbs of Sacramento in 1948. Within 2 years, contributions made possible the purchase of a 7-acre plot, empty of even a single tree. On that barren rectangle, Swami had ventured to start the construction of a branch center, sending a crew of the brothers who, by practicing at Olema, had now become proficient builders. More than 7 years' work on this property was already behind them when I was sent there. After a few weeks, when I returned briefly, Swami Ashokananda asked how I was getting along. I think I grumbled about missing my friends in the old temple, the familiar atmosphere, the rituals and services. I was hesitant to mention that I missed the Swami himself. "That's right," he said cheerfully. "You will be less well off mentally, but you will be better off physically. Less headache, is it not so?" I had to admit that it was. He had once told everyone, "You have to get splashed in the mud of Vedanta." Finding the mud of Vedanta atmosphere of brick and mortar at Sacramento, with its workshop and drafting table, somewhat culturally depriving, I suggested to the brothers that some of us might meet in a wide-ranging discussion group, periodic and optional, to discuss issues of the day, etc., and some had readily agreed with me. It hadn't occurred to me that we might need permission. Shortly there came a personal phone call. "Did I tell you to do that?" asked the familiar voice. "No, Swamiji, no, don't do that. This is not college. You see, all of you are living in an environment of hard work and raw materials. You must live as close to God as possible. Create the spiritual atmosphere there by giving all your spare time to the talk and thought of Him." Another day he came on a visit, covering all the grounds and buildings with his probing and loving eye. "Do you make japa?" he asked me. I said yes, but knowing that my habit fell short of the level he meant. "Yes, you must," he said. "You cannot simply be a worker." And he branded the words on my mind with the fire in his eyes. The Sacramento work went ahead, but not without sweat and tears, and yes, even blood, when a monk sustained a serious injury. When I was absent for nearly a year on special assignment, I received from Swami this rare and intimate acknowledgement of that dedication of the monks, an expression of what it had meant to him. He said, "I hope you will be able to return here soon, as soon as Swami Madhavananda, whom I was nursing, leaves for India. After very hard labor, the monks at Sacramento were able to finish sowing the lawn just before the rains seemed to be starting. I cannot be too grateful to Del, Phil, Jim, and the others for this tremendous work. In a sense, Swami Ashokananda concluded his expansion work with the dedication of the new temple in 1959. That building had been forced upon him by the eroding condition of the old temple, and the intervening years had taken their toll on his health. This dedication he set about with everything he could muster. Host to 9 senior swamis from around the country, he planned all of their housing, food, and entertainment, assigning each a place on the program, several days of ritual ceremony, music, and speeches ensued. Swami wore his Indian robes, monk's robes, for the ceremonies of each day. It was the first time I had seen them on him, and led all the items on the program like an emperor. The visiting swamis made numerous comments on how memorable this occasion was becoming, and what an atmosphere it was creating. If one had wondered at the sudden efflorescence of Indian ritual worship, so uncharacteristic of the tradition of his regime, Swami would surely have replied, as I once heard him reply, "Well, if you are going to do ritual worship, why not give him your very best flowers, most expensive perfumes, your most delicious food? Is there anything that is good enough for him?" The new temple was strong, solid, impressive, and resplendent. In that remarkable new auditorium, Swami Ashokananda seemed to draw a larger audience. By 1965, when I left for India, the attendance, when he spoke on Sunday mornings, was commonly 275. End of section.